Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Last week, the U.S. Justice Department announced its plans to take legal action to force the state of Texas to seek federal approval before making changes to its election laws. The move comes weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, requiring some southern states and jurisdictions to obtain such permission from the federal government. While Missouri isn't one of the states included in that provision of the Voting Rights Act, it still got us thinking, are there any modern barriers to voting in the state? Today on Intersection, we'll explore that question and talk about ways to make voting more accessible. Joining me in studio today, Nancy Copenhaver is a former state representative and currently serves on the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mary Ratliff is the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, a position she's held for over 20 years. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. The Advancement Project is a nonprofit civil rights organization. Thanks for being joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Do you agree with the Supreme Court decision to strike down a section of the Voting Rights Act? Why or why not? Give us a call at 573-882-8925, or you can email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And we'll go ahead and start our discussion there, I suppose. I know you've all been following the Supreme Court ruling pretty closely, but maybe, Denise, we could start with you to help explain briefly what the Supreme Court ruled and what the impact might be.
Well, thanks. You know, the Supreme Court dealt a crushing blow to the civil rights and voting rights of millions of Americans several weeks ago when it struck the coverage formula for a key provision of the Voting Rights Act that required states that had a history of discrimination in voting to have new voting practices pre-cleared through the federal government, either through the Justice Department or through a federal court. And effectively, that means that no states have to go through that critical preclearance process. And we've already seen the fallout. Within hours of the Supreme Court's decision, state governments in Texas and Alabama and Mississippi announced that they were rushing to implement restrictive voting laws, laws that had already, in some cases, been found to be racially discriminatory. And in the weeks that followed, we've seen other states rush to pass restrictive voting legislation, the most recent being North Carolina passing last Thursday night a broad sweeping restriction on voting rights, probably the most restrictive voting law in the country, a law that before the Supreme Court's ruling would have had to go through the preclearance process and had to be vetted for its discriminatory impact. And now states can rush to the table to enact these laws without that crucial stopgap.
Right. And it seems, at least in the interim, that's definitely the case. It looks like, though, Congress is at least looking at this issue and making some sort of other proposal.
Well, that's what's going to have to happen in order for the preclearance protections to be reenacted. Those weren't struck down by the court, but the coverage formula that determined which states would have to abide by it was struck down. And that will take an act of Congress to reinstitute. In the meantime, it's going to fall on the voters and their advocates to fight for their rights in the courts, in the streets, in the legislatures. What we've seen for the last 13 weeks at North Carolina is nothing short of amazing. Thousands of people gathering every Monday for Moral Mondays on the lawn of the state capitol of North Carolina, thousands of people at a time, over 900 people already arrested, trying to speak out against those proposed voting measures that the legislature adopted last week. And it's going to fall on advocates like that right here in Missouri as we anticipate new measures hitting the table next year when the legislature comes to bear. And it's going to fall on lawyers and advocates to use the courts and the legal system to find other ways to fight these attacks on voting rights.
Sure. And the ruling, it doesn't seem like it's going to have, correct me if I'm wrong, any direct effect, since Missouri was not one of those states or districts included in it. But what effect do any of you think this decision may have in Missouri?
It could very well, because of the striking down of Amendment 4, it means that Missouri could very well, and we've seen the leaning in that direction in the with the photo ID, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that means that we can be looking and with the conservative legislators that we have, that we are expecting to be looking at some kind of changes in the law by next session. So it could have a devastating effect upon the voters in Missouri as well.
Nancy, look like
right. We've been fighting this issue for 7 or 8 years in the legislature anyway, and mm-hmm. and each year it gets a little bit closer to being in effect. So it just makes it that much more difficult, especially when things are hitting in other states as well. It just makes it crucial. And you know, as I've heard said several times, and Denise mentioned the civil rights, that this is the civil rights issue of our day.
Absolutely.
That's
right. And what the Supreme Court decision did was create a climate throughout the country, not only right. in those Section 5 states that were covered by that coverage formula, but created a climate where restrictions on voting rights can be rushed through the process, and it's creating a very hostile climate to voters in this country, in states all over America. And that's why it's going to fall on advocates like my organization, the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, to step up and assert the rights of voters. And we can certainly expect to see those attacks come again here in Missouri. We've been fighting restrictive photo ID proposals here in this state since 2006, and have every reason to believe that we will see that legislation come up again in the next legislative session.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today on the show, as the federal government debates how to move forward after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, we're talking about modern-day barriers to voting in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio today are Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors and a former state representative, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, a position she's held for over 20 years, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. And for you and our audience, do you think Missouri should have stricter voter ID laws? Why or why not? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. And you've all brought up the issue that I would like to talk a little bit about, the voter ID legislation that's been proposed here in the state. And again, it's something that's been going on around the country. What currently is the situation with voter ID? What do people have to show at the polls this point?
Now they don't have to show a government-issued voter ID, and that's only because it passed the legislators. The governor vetoed it. Such a bill. And many of the older people, many of low-income and African-American people do not have government-issued ID. They have valid ID that is acceptable every place else, student IDs and all of those things. None of those things would be valid if that photo ID law was allowed to stand. And if we had a governor who was willing to veto that, had it not been for that, then we would have a photo ID law, which would have disenfranchised thousands of voters. Because they would not have, and it is costly, and some say that it won't cost anything, but it does. There are people that live in different parts of the country that would of the state that would be considerable travel time. Some of them don't have transportation, et cetera, to get to the area where they for them to even have the photo taken if they were, if it was available to them even free of charge. And it is, we should be in this country, we should be encouraging, doing everything that we can to encourage individuals to vote rather than to try to suppress it.
And Denise?
Well, and that's the clear intent of these provisions, is to prevent valid voters from exercising their rights to cast a ballot. Missouri was one of 38 states that introduced the same type of restrictive voter ID legislation. This is part of a national coordinated effort, and there is no legitimate basis for such a law in Missouri. Missouri law already requires all voters to show identification at the polls. We have a law that already ensures that voters have to prove they are who they say they are. What these proposals would do is unnecessarily and unduly limit the forms of identification that voters could show to just a very few, and a few that are very difficult, require you to provide all kinds of underlying documentation like a certified birth certificate and other identifying items that can be expensive and sometimes even impossible to obtain.
So in Missouri, some of the proposals seem, how would that have changed? What could you show? What do you have to show now that you wouldn't be able to show in the future? I guess there's some examples of non-photo IDs.
Right. So right now, for example, if you go to college at University of Missouri at Columbia, a state government-run institution, and you have a student ID with your photograph on it, that right now is a valid form of identification that that you can show at the polls. Under the proposed photo ID laws in Missouri, that would no longer be an acceptable form of identification. If your grandmother has a Missouri driver's license that's recently expired, that is currently an acceptable form of identification. It's got her photo. It identifies her as who she is. Under the proposed regulations, it would have to be a non-expired photo ID that no longer would be acceptable. If you recently moved to Missouri, established your residency here, registered to vote, or are in college here, but have a driver's license from another state that adequately identifies who you are, that's currently acceptable ID. It would not be acceptable ID under the proposal. Registration card. The card that the government sends you to verify that, in fact, you're a registered voter, you can currently use that as a form of identification, would not be allowed under these proposals.
Those that sponsor this legislation often claim that it is say that it's for the sake of voter fraud prevention. What's your reaction to that, Nancy?
They never seem to be able to show any example of any voter fraud that this is going to help solve. Any instances that may have been problems in voting are never ID fraud. People just don't present themselves as someone else to vote. And it's a solution looking for a problem because there really isn't a problem there.
Absolutely. They've not been able to, they talk about they're trying to prevent voter fraud, but there's absolutely no evidence present to warrant such restrictive laws being put into place. So it is obviously for political posturing that these laws are being introduced, and for voter suppression is what. That's the bottom line.
Well, Mary, maybe you could expand on that. In what ways would this suppress voters?
It would suppress voters in that there would be many people who would not be eligible to vote because of these stringent laws that are put into place. And we believe that this took place after a concerted effort on the parts of many organizations to register, increase those individuals who are registered and who are voting. And so we believe that the suppression is meant to is a political ploy to disenfranchise certain individuals from voting, because it's been the low income and people of color that have been mostly affected.
Well, and Denise talked about seniors, how they would be affected, but
and
I guess
seniors.
Specifically, I guess the minorities and low income, how would they be affected in this situation? I guess take us through how these changes would.
Because some of the things that I had started to explain, and Denise can maybe explain it in more detail than I can, because of some of the things that I've talked about and the economics of it all, and folks who live in rural Missouri or rural states, wherever it is, who do not have transportation, who do not have there are individuals who don't even have birth certificates, can't find their birth certificates to even start, because you know you have to have birth certificate to start the process of the identification that they are requiring. And there are many folks that just don't have that. There are many low-income and African-American folks who do not have that, but have established themselves as citizens and have voted, for instance, the 102-year-old woman in the past, you know, election, who had been voting for years, and all of a sudden they are told that they can't vote. And I think that, Reverend, when we talked about the law being left, you know, the Fifth Amendment being left, the Fourth Amendment being struck down, I think that Reverend Al Sharpton said it best, is that you left the car and took the key away, you know? And that's kind of what happened with this Supreme Court decision.
Sorry, Denise and Nancy both wanted to speak up there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Mary hit right on the nose. Yeah, we already know. We've done a comparison. The Secretary of State's office has done a look at the voter files here in Missouri, and we know that upwards of 250,000 valid registered voters in the state of Missouri who have identification to identify themselves don't have the strict forms of identification that would be required under these proposals. We also know studies have been done to show that voters of color, especially African Americans, are twice as likely to lack a state-issued photo ID. Senior citizens, because these IDs have to be unexpired, are also about twice as likely to lack a state-issued photo ID, as are young voters who tend to move, may not have a state driver's license, low-income voters who are also less likely to have a state driver's license, which is the most common form of ID acceptable, and voters with disabilities. And for these populations who are up to twice as likely to lack a state-issued photo ID, the barriers to obtaining one can be very difficult, if not impossible. It's impossible if you don't have that birth certificate. So people who are born at home, disproportionately voters of color, especially those who were born during days of segregation, were born at home. Rural voters, born at home. Or people that have a glitch on their birth certificate. My own mother stood to be disenfranchised. She was an elected official here in Missouri, but there's a glitch on her birth certificate. The name on that birth certificate doesn't match the name on her voter registration, and she doesn't have a way to prove that she's the same person that was on her birth certificate. Those are the kinds of people that stand to be affected by these laws, and voters who would have difficulty either getting to the offices necessary to obtain all of the underlying documents necessary to get an ID, or don't have the ability to do so due to physical disabilities, would also be substantially impaired from exercising their right to vote. And Mary's absolutely right. This is about politics, first and foremost. And one thing that voters don't like is politicians attempting to manipulate the system for their political gain. And that's exactly what these laws are about. We need to be looking at measures like instituting advance early voting in Missouri, no excuse absentee voting in Missouri, that would make voting more accessible for our state's voters, not less. We should be looking at ways to make voting more free, fair, and accessible for all our state's voters.
Now, Nancy, exactly. we had to cut you off a couple times.
One of the things that is often said when they're trying to pass these restrictive photo ID laws is that we will exempt anybody born before a certain date, so it really won't adversely affect senior citizens. But that's not really true, because all those people are going to get to vote is a provisional ballot, mm-hmm. and provisional ballots are rarely counted, and that's just not really the same thing. And to say that they are not being taken their right of voting away is just not true. The attempts themselves will discourage people from going to the polls because they will think, well, if I'm going to have to hassle with somebody to try to prove who I am, or I'm going to have to go through all these steps, I just won't bother. Mm-hmm. And that's what the people who are trying to pass these laws are hoping will happen.
Absolutely.
People will just give up. And Denise is exactly right. What we should be doing, and is what the League of Women Voters wants to do, is to encourage more people to vote, not fewer, by providing advanced voting, no excuse absentee voting. You know, we're really operating a voting system in this country that is decades, if not hundreds of years old, and we're not the same society we used to be. Voting only in one period of time is really very restrictive to open it up. I just think, for instance, of when I was a kid, how many businesses were open 24 hours a day? The hospitals and law enforcement would probably be it. Now you have thousands of businesses that are open 24 hours a day. People work all kinds of different shifts. We need to be more flexible to allow them to vote when they can get to the polls.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today on the show, as the federal government debates how to move forward after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, we're talking about modern-day barriers to voting in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio today are Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors and a former state representative, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, a position she's held for over 20 years, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Are there other barriers to voting that we haven't mentioned? Let us know what you think. Share your thoughts and give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And we actually did get a question from our chat room from Tyrone I wanted to bring in here. He asked, how do the presenters feel about the use of fingerprint technologies instead of IDs? I think that would solve all of our concerns. So I guess just scanning your fingerprint when you go in to vote. Any thoughts?
I am a little reluctant to, I'm a little reluctant to fingerprinting because I'm not sure how it would be used. And so that would be something that I would have to.
You mean the records, I suppose,
right,
of fingerprints?
Right. I'm just saying that I don't know how. I think that people would have a few problems with that, and I don't know. I would have to do more in looking into that, and I hadn't thought that much about it. I just know that at the banks now, you can, you know, they can use fingerprints. I chose not to do that because I didn't want to, you know, because I thought it was too invasive. And I don't know how people will feel about, you know, about that. And so I don't know what I have mixed emotions about.
Sure.
I can't imagine what the cost would be to change all of our systems to allow for that. And knowing the way that Missouri traditionally is without wanting to spend any money to do anything accurately or precisely, I could imagine that would be very costly. And, you know, one of the problems that we have right now with elections is that the state keeps passing laws that add additional requirements and additional cost to the local election authorities. Mm-hmm. And they aren't getting any more money to run these elections. Now, in places like Boone County, where they have a terrifically competent and probably one of the best county clerks in the state.
In the nation.
She managed, or in the nation, you're
yes.
right.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy Norin.
Wendy
yeah.
usually manages to do whatever's necessary to get things done properly. But in many of these smaller counties, they're having a great deal of difficulties doing things now with the increased requirements that are being made without increased financing for those.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, yeah, Mary or Denise, your thoughts on that as well, and how that maybe inhibits, maybe moving on from the voter ID idea, how that inhibits the way people are able to vote in Missouri.
I don't know that, you know, how you know, how much it would cost, but I do know that it would be that would be an additional cost, and then I would be concerned about certainly some folks would have to be trained on, you know, just interpreting and looking at the fingerprinting and all of that. That would be considerable amount of resources. So you know, all of that would have to be taken into consideration. As I said, and I haven't had a long time to ponder this, but my feelings would be I would not be for that at this point.
But I guess, too, maybe Denise, you can help on this, too. The funding that goes in, you brought it up, Nancy, the funding that local authorities get to run these elections, how has that changed over the last few years?
Well, it's up to the state to allocate funding to the local election authorities to carry out their duties. I mean, the problem is that the local election authorities carry the largest burden under Missouri election law in carrying out elections. They are the ones that are charged under our state laws with most of the processes of getting an election in place and carrying out those laws. And many of these local communities are cash strapped to be able to do so. And they're many of our local election officials are doing a yeoman's job with very limited budgets. And so for the state to impose additional requirements, we believe requires the state to allocate those funds through the Missouri state budgeting process. And provisions like a photo ID law are extremely expensive to implement because of the constitutional protections that are afforded to voters, because voting is a fundamental right, unlike cashing a check at a bank or boarding an airplane. Estimates are that a photo ID law in Missouri could run anywhere from $7 to $20 million to be able to implement, to be able to provide identification to all voters, to notify voters, to educate voters. Difficult and expensive tasks, and placing significant additional burdens on already strapped local election authorities.
And, you know, many of these local election authorities are running elections with totally volunteer staff. Many of those volunteers are people who've done this for years and years and years. They are not computer literate. They are they receive a few hours training once a year on how to do things. Everything has gotten more complicated and more technical. And quite honestly, these election authorities are having a difficulty staffing the elections. If we continually increase the difficulty and the cost, we're really going to scare people away from taking on this responsibility. And that's kind of a sad situation, too. It really is.
And is it more difficult than these smaller communities in rural areas, I suppose?
Particularly it is, right. You have, for instance, a lot of people who don't work, who are retired, who in past years they were oftentimes the farmers' wives who served working at the elections. And it's more and more difficult to get people to spend that time for the little amount of compensation they get and the training they have to undergo and the complications of the machinery, the new laws that keep coming out. It just becomes more and more difficult, as well as more expensive.
Absolutely. And we're going to have to take a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today on the show, we're talking about modern day barriers to voting in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. I'm Ryan Femuelner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today on the show, as the federal government debates how to move forward after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, we're talking about modern-day barriers to voting in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors and a former state representative, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, a position she's held for over 20 years, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. And for you and our audience, how serious are these threats to the right to vote? How do you think the government should act to protect that right? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. One of the things that all of you, I think, brought up before the break that would be good to go back to is the idea of early voting or those no-excuse absentee vote. Why haven't those been passed in Missouri? They have in other states.
Nancy? I think a lot of times they've been tied to other things, like the photo ID, the idea that we'll give you this if you give us that kind of thing. And there's also been a disagreement about how to handle the advance voting. And quite honestly, it's expensive. It's going to add additional costs to the elections. It will add additional work for the election authorities. And to be able to fairly set up a plan that works just as well in metropolitan St. Louis and Kansas City as it does in rural northern Missouri, it's very difficult. Because in a county that only has 20,000 people, if you have one location for advance voting, that's probably adequate. But it's not adequate in St. Louis. You have to have them a number of different locations, and you have to have them accessible to the people. And then, of course, if you do that, you have to staff them, and you have to provide all kinds of facilities for that. And the logistics of getting it all done have just been difficult. You know, some states are even doing voting over the computer or phone voting or mail-in voting. So there are all kinds of new ways that we need to be looking at doing things, I think.
That's right. Nice. You know, the fact is the logistics for early voting are not that difficult. Missouri is by far an outlier in this area. The vast majority of states have some form of early voting and no excuse absentee voting. 31 states have early voting already, in-person early voting before Election Day, and it works. In the states that have early voting, what we have seen is a tremendous increase in people participating, particularly where they allow voter registration to occur during that early voting period. And that's one of the reasons that our Secretary of State, Jason Cantor, established a commission to study early voting that was convened this year, that met. My organization submitted testimony to that commission, and that commission ended up, it was a bipartisan commission that included Republican and Democratic former election officials, as well as other statewide officials and community members, and they recommended that Missouri adopt an early voting provision. It makes sense. It doesn't cost a jurisdiction substantially more money. It allows more people to participate in the process, and actually what we found in studies around the country is that it actually eases the burden on overworked poll workers on election day. And most importantly, after the 2012 elections, what we know is that effective early voting reduces long lines. There's a direct correlation to opportunities to vote early and reduced lines on election day.
Right. Getting back to the conversation we had before the break, I just wanted to put in a comment from – we got a comment – via email from Dr. Artie Langston. I think he was referring likely to the voter ID conversation. He says, everything these ladies are saying is absolutely correct. Even the Bush administration concluded there was no significant voter fraud. This is a coordinated attempt nationwide to bring back Jim Crow, only now it targets more than just people of color to include a variety of likely Democrat voters. I guess your thoughts on that, his claim there that it's a coordinated attempt nationwide. How do these laws come into place? It has been something that many states have been looking at.
I think that it was quite evident in these past couple of elections that there were attempts to put restrictive measures into place to discourage and prevent certain groups of people from voting, because in the last election in 08, wasn't it? 2008, I think it was. When we had such an outpouring of new voters, mm-hmm. Then really the effort really picked up to suppress the voters in this past election, and I think that the efforts to change the laws and to place more restrictive measures on the voters was absolutely political and had to do with restricting those people who had not voted in the past, who had been recruited to vote, that those efforts were put in place absolutely to weed out many of the voters that had been recruited and those that would be coming in the future. I think that was quite apparent, and it's all political.
And the coordinated effort.
I mean, there's
totally
no doubt whatsoever that this was a national coordinated effort, and it was a well-funded one, backed by organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council that put forth and drafted restrictive voting legislation after the 2010 midterm elections, when they garnered legislative majorities in states around the country and farmed those bills out to the states. That's why we saw 38 photo ID bills on state legislatures that year.
Absolutely.
They're identical. That if you go into these various states where these proposals are being made, they read word for word. So
absolutely.
The caller is exactly right. It was a coordinated effort, and it is being pushed by ALEC as it is in there are a number of other areas where they're trying to change the laws in all of the states as a means of gaining more power.
Absolutely.
And to move on to another question we had, to this original question of what are some of these barriers, we talked about it briefly earlier, but specifically in rural areas, what are we hearing from rural areas about limitations to vote, issues with trying to get to the polls, that sort of thing?
Well, one of the problems that we have in rural areas is that a lot of times we are now closing the number of polls so that people have to travel a little bit farther to get to them. And that is basically a cost issue. Sometimes it's because there are fewer people there as well, but part of it is a cost issue. Part of it is the difficulty in obtaining the people to work at the polls, or the difficulty obtaining a location. For instance, we used to hold elections in rural areas in a lot of schools. Well, after 9/11, it was a scary thing for school districts to have their schools open with the children there and people coming and going all day long. And so many of the schools have ceased to hold elections. And then it becomes very difficult to find a place that is handicap accessible, that has good parking, that, you know, that has air conditioning or heat in the winter. So therefore, it just makes it more difficult to have those kinds of elections. And there is also the problem, too, in the cost of running these elections. For instance, I know in the last election we had redistricting that happened right before the election. And it would have been nice had voters gotten a notification that they were now in a different legislative district or a different senatorial district. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't possible. The law only requires the county clerks to do that every 2 years. So they didn't have the kind of money it took to do that. So there were a lot of people who came to vote thinking they were in one district and they weren't. Mm-hmm. They were in a different district. And there were a lot of people who, quite frankly, voted in the wrong districts.
I do want to remind our listeners to please call in if you'd like to share your perspectives. We do have another comment from our chat room, Tyrone. We heard from him earlier. He's got another comment here about early voting we talked about a little bit ago. He said early voting may allow people to participate and reduce lines, but it reduces informed voting. What if late-breaking scandals pop up after many people have voted? What do you respond to that, I guess?
Well, that's a good point. The thing is, I do think that early voting will change the whole the whole idea of campaigns, because many campaigns operate under the circumstances that people aren't even looking at the issues or the candidates until, say, a week before the election. So they target most of their campaigning to that period of time. And that kind of does overload and a lot of citizens just simply tune out and that kind of thing. So it's going to require, I think, campaigns to become more thorough and cover the issues better and better inform the voters. Of course, that's something that the League of Women Voters has worked hard to do over the years, too, is to try to make sure that we have informed voters as well. But that's always a problem if something comes up at the end, that because there are some people that vote absentee and then an issue comes up and they wish they had voted somewhat differently, but that just can't be.
Right, and I don't think that we have a mechanism to close that particular gap, because something can happen within a week or you know, scandals can break any time that could affect the outcome of an election and I don't think that to prevent or not have early voting or for that particular reason, I think that we spend a lot of time, we can not look at candidates without really giving a lot of, doing a lot of background check on them prior to an election time. So we have no way of preventing something from coming out in that last few days, that last week, and we've had that happen in the past. And, you know, there's nothing that you can do about that. But I don't think that it is prevalent enough to prevent or keep us from, I think the benefits outweigh.
We have another chat.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have another chat room comment here from Byron. He says, I'm not sure I have a problem with requiring voters to have an ID. I've heard the complaint that many of these people don't have transportation. How did they register to vote in the first place? I feel like citizens have a certain amount of responsibility to participate in their governments. And if they won't make a minimal effort, do we need their voice? Voting is a right, but it's also a responsibility. Citizens need to assume some of the responsibility in assuring their vote is heard.
Can I speak to that?
Sure.
We have never, the NAACP have never objected to voter ID. We've objected to photo voter ID.
And we have voter ID in the state currently.
That's exactly right. And we believe that everybody should have proper identification to vote. But we do not believe that it is necessary that they have a government-issued photo ID. Certainly, a University of Missouri student with an ID on it ought to be valid ID that they are who they, and with other supporting document if you need it, you know. That should be an adequate ID, and it should not be a government-issued photo ID. We want it to be quite clear that we have never been opposed to our voter ID, but to photo ID.
Our law in Missouri already requires all voters to show ID, right? I mean, it's about restricting it. We should be taking steps not to make our voting process more difficult than it has to be. And that's precisely what these photo ID bills do. They don't provide any additional amount of integrity to the voting process. Missouri law already requires voters to be able to demonstrate who they are.
Yeah, and so directly, I guess, again, Byron's comment, voting's a right, but it's also a responsibility. What's anybody's reaction to that specific question?
All voters already have to take steps to register to vote in this state. You have to do so with 30 days prior to an election. You have to appear at your polling place with one of the specified forms of identification. I mean, there's already steps there, but the whole point of a democracy is that we facilitate the ability of people to be able to have a voice and have a say in their government and not make it more difficult than it has to be. And that's what these laws and restrictions do.
And even if they don't restrict, there is that perception by some people that is being made so difficult and so complicated that they just give up. And I think that's part of the the ulterior motive behind those that are trying to do the voter suppression is that people will just simply say, it is too much trouble, I'm not going to bother. And I don't think that's good for our democracy.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today on the show, as the federal government debates how to move forward after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, we're talking about modern-day barriers to voting in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio today are Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors and a former state representative, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, a position she's held for over 20 years, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. For you and our audience, do you think the state should have term limits for elected officials? Why or why not? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. That is one question we wanted to spend a couple minutes chatting about because it's something that comes up when you talk about barriers to vote and things that change. You have brought up redistricting as well, but these term limits here in Missouri, maybe just a few minutes of your thoughts on how those do affect voting options in the state.
Well, you know, we do have term limits. The voters can turn people out, and that would be the best way, I think, of term limits. But the restrictive term limits that we have in Missouri at this point, which are 8 years or four terms of 2 years each for state representatives and 8 years for state senators, are so restrictive that they're just a number of reasons that they aren't working. People don't have enough time to thoroughly learn the job and make the connections and the personal relationships with the other legislators that it takes to make efficient legislation. I think Chris Kelly has brought this out a number of times because of his longevity from prior years, how he has learned how to work within the system to get things done. And it's just more difficult to do that. Plus, then you have people who are always looking for where their next step is going to be. So they're 1 foot in and 1 foot out and moving on into another job, sometimes before their term is even up. That's another problem. And then you have the problem with the people who are the bureaucrats who've been around for a number of years, the department people, the lobbyists who really understand the issues much more, and the legislators become much more reliant upon them than they are on their own abilities to craft legislation, which then I think takes it away from the democratic process.
Right. The supposed problem here, though, is I guess that you may have legislators that are able to stay in power for years and years, as long as they would like, basically, once they've established connections and established time. What's that flip side? What's your argument against that, I suppose?
Well, if you have voters who study the issues and understand what's going on, if that person is in for a long period of time and is not serving the public well, then they should be voted out. And in a situation in Missouri where you have a large House of Representatives and the representatives are fairly close to the people that they represent. Each one represents just about 35, 36,000 people. You're much more likely to know who that person is. And it is possible to get rid of somebody who's been there too long. But it's also possible that somebody could be there for a long time because they are a very effective legislator.
Okay. I have to leave for a minute.
Oh, okay. That should be fine. Well, Denise, maybe you can help us move to another part of the conversation that we can get to Mary with when she comes back as well. But one thing that comes up often when we talk about voting rights is what happens with felons. It's different from state to state. Denise, yes. You could have a good perspective on this. But what's the situation in Missouri compared to other states?
Right. Well, Missouri is one of a number of states that that restrict your ability to vote if you've been convicted of a felony, both during the time that you are serving your sentence, but also while you are under any type of government supervision, under probation or parole. But after that point, your rights are restored and you have the right to register and vote again. There are a number of other states where the laws are a little more restrictive, where sometimes people lose their right to vote for life. right? So like Virginia, Florida have very restrictive laws. The laws, particularly in states in the South, these laws were enacted, many of them in the post-Reconstruction era as a way to target newly eligible African American voters and targeting crimes that they were more likely to be charged and convicted with. We are seeing efforts in some places. Virginia, for example, the governor loosened some of the requirements for voters to be able to seek executive clemency, which is what's required in that state now, in order to be able to gain their rights back. But the flip side just happened in Florida in 2011, where the governor made it harder to do so. Now in Florida, felons have to wait 5 years after they're out before they can even apply to the governor to get clemency, to get any of their civil rights restored. But here in Missouri, you lose your rights during incarceration, probation, and parole, and then have them reestablished.
Right.
The problem with that, too, is that many times a felon who has served his time on probation or parole, and then is back in the community, still thinks he doesn't have the right to vote or has no idea how to regain that right to vote and is discouraged from participating. And this could be somebody who was in for a very short period of time, and that means that for the rest of their life they're not voting. And that's a very sad situation too.
And there's certainly a lot of challenges with folks attempting to reassert their rights. And that's another problem that we see often in the voter registration process. And we know that in getting people engaged, giving them a sense of ownership and responsibility in their community by registering to vote is a significant way to reduce recidivism.
And Denise, one thing, I wish Mary was here to talk about this at the moment. Maybe you could speak to the fact that this does also affect minority populations more than it does.
Vastly. Yeah. People of color are vastly much more likely to be swept up in this system, right? Like 7-1, more likely to not have their rights to vote. In some states in the South, you have huge percentages of African-American adults who are completely blocked out of the democratic process. We are continuing as a nation to come up with more and more ways to exclude people from the democratic process. And this does not aid our democracy.
And you know, Brian, another issue that we haven't even touched on is the difficulty that our citizens have to vote when they're abroad, particularly our citizens who are serving in National Guard locations overseas, our active military people. You know, we have to be sure that we're protecting their right to vote and to vote in a reasonable time limit so that their votes are managed to get back in time to be counted and aren't excluded from the process.
Is it the challenge there, just the lead time, I guess?
Right, that's the lead time, and especially when you have, like in the last couple of elections, when you had soldiers who were in the field in Afghanistan or Iraq, and they're way out in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, communication is very difficult. It's not easy for them to file an affidavit that says they're voting absentee. You know, mail might take a long time to get there. We have to be more modernized the ways of voting so that we can do it over the computer if we want to, or Skype, or however we want to do that, so that these people are not denied their right to vote too.
That's right. It's a real conundrum. We have been looking at ways to incorporate technology into that overseas and remote voting process, but in many respects the technology is not secure enough yet for measures like internet voting, online voting, because of the importance of anonymity in the voting process.
Okay. We have another comment from Byron. It'll take us back to the voter ID conversation, but I wanted to get in his perspective one more time. He said, having worked my way through college at a liquor store located near a college campus, I can attest to how easy it is to create a phony ID, particularly when someone isn't familiar with how a certain state ID is supposed to appear. You mentioned some of the people working elections are undertrained. Would it not be easier to have them only look for one type of ID? I know I have no idea what an MU student ID looks like. How would I know if it's legit?
Well, I don't think I would be opposed to the fact that if everybody who registered to vote got a registration card, put their picture on it, and let them vote with that. That would be fine. That is free. It would be established. But The problem is that would be an expensive operation to do, to start from scratch to take care of all the voters. And you're right. A state-issued ID isn't going to solve any problems because it is easy to copy those.
So you're saying the identification you already get when you register to vote, just throw a photo on that, if the state were to take the responsibility for doing that.
Certainly.
Well, you know, some states are looking at the possibility of things like electronic poll books where they coordinate with the state agent, DMV agencies, motor vehicle agencies. But those things are still really in kind of an infantile process of getting coordinated. And there's still a lot of glitches in those kinds of systems at this
particularly
point.
When you're dealing with volunteer poll workers.
And there are people who have already established their citizenship, who have voter ID cards, et cetera. I don't think that large, vast number of individuals should have to resort to having a reissued ID card just to get a photo, you know, on that particular card. I think that we should be doing everything that we can if there was a big issue with voter fraud, then I could understand why we would be going to all of these measures and with all of the increased cost resources that would be needed to implement a new plan. I think that if we had evidence of large voter fraud, that may be something that we need to be looking at. But that is not the case.
I'm glad Mary brought us back to that because the whole idea, if that were the case, it might make sense. But the whole purpose is not really for that fraud because we've said that it doesn't exist. The whole purpose is voter suppression and to try to manipulate elections, which is not good.
And Denise, we have about a minute left in the show. I wanted to get back to one other quick thought. You mentioned early in the show that you thought that this was brought up this year, didn't get through, but voter ID you thought specifically would be brought up in Missouri. I know your organization has worked in the past. What do you expect it to be brought back up, and what will your organization do if it is?
Absolutely. You know, Missouri is sort of a poster child in the photo ID wars, being one of the first states in the nation to pass a strict photo ID law. And you know what? That law was struck down by our Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court concluded that those photo ID requirements would violate the fundamental right to vote of Missouri voters for all the reasons that my panelists stated here today. And indeed, every year since then, the Missouri legislature has attempted to do an end run around that Supreme Court decision by introducing legislation to actually strip out part of our voting rights out of the state constitution. They ended up passing such a ballot measure in 2011. My organization, along with several others, was successful in getting that struck from the ballot. A court found that it was deceptive and misleading to Missouri voters. Governor Nixon also vetoed legislation that would have required and imposed those requirements.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks, Denise. Appreciate it. But thanks for that last thought. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Nancy Copenhaver, a member of the Missouri League of Women Voters Board of Directors, Mary Ratliff, the president of the Missouri chapter of the NAACP, and joining us via Skype from St. Louis, Denise Lieberman, the senior attorney for the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Today's producers are Janet Saidi, Raymond Tungekar, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Casey Morell and Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Femuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.